I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we begin again today in Oklahoma, where the state's insurance department estimates that damage from Monday's monster tornado could top $2 billion, and the Oklahoma Medical Examiner says it's identified 23 of the 24 people killed, 10 children, including two infants. Officials are beginning to release the names. Yesterday, we mentioned a mother and child who sought shelter in a freezer at that 7-Eleven that was leveled. They were killed. We now know their names, 29-year-old Megan Futrell and her four-month-old infant, Case. Meanwhile, today, the mayor of Moore said he's going to push for a new law requiring storm shelters or safe rooms in all new homes as residents there start to think about what's next. Rachel Hubbard is with KOSU in Oklahoma City. She's outside Moore. And Rachel, before we talk about this push for safe rooms, we're hearing these names. I mean, just what is it like there today?
Well, there's still a lot of frustration. I am actually attempting to get into one of the neighborhoods to work on a story, and we had previously gained permission. But today, law enforcement has gone back on what they had promised residents yesterday and are only allowing immediate family back into many of the worst-hit neighborhoods. And so I'm sitting in a grocery store parking lot right now with armies of volunteers that these families have organized in an attempt to go in and get their stuff out, and they're stuck. They can't do anything.
Well, it's probably understandable that there's maybe a little bit of confusion in law enforcement wanting to protect neighborhoods and a conflict there, as we hear. But what's the sense of this push for safe rooms? Tell us a little bit about them. We're going to be speaking with an engineer in a second about, you know, reinforcing walls, perhaps. But what are people talking about when they're talking about safe rooms?
What they do is they go in, and many times they're installed in the garage. So they go in and they cut a portion of the concrete out in your garage, and then they drop in this steel safe room, and these things are extremely small. In most cases, a full-size person couldn't stand up in them, and typically they cost between $1 and $2,500 to install in an existing home.
So you would drop into them, and they're below ground. But would you explain why are there so few basements instead of these safe rooms?
I think that a lot of that has to do with soil content. It's an expansive and contracting soil. For example, the cellar, it was an outdoor cellar that we had in the home that I grew up in, and it was old, but it caved in because of the continued overtime expanding and contracting.
Right. We understand it's more of a clay soil, so it's not as stable, and it also can flood easily. So there's this call now for these insertable safe rooms. What is the law right now? We know Alabama is the only state that requires all new construction to have a safe room. We know that schools across Oklahoma, there's about 100 safe rooms in schools. What are the laws in the state for safe rooms?
Well, there currently aren't any laws in the state, and the Oklahoma legislature is winding down its legislative session, so the time for getting new legislation out has really passed. But the problem is, it used to be a fairly common thing for churches and schools and other places to offer the basements and underground rooms that they did have that built many of them as fallout shelters in the 50s. But because of increased liability issues, many of these have now closed to the general public. So the access in the community to storm shelters is going down rather than going up, which is why many people are installing these underground safe rooms in their garages.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of questions being asked about new schools being built and why are there no storm shelters in the new schools.
You say you recently saw a school built with no safe area, even though this town has had two devastating tornadoes prior to this one.
Another community that we cover for KOSU is Stillwater. And Stillwater is building currently three new elementary schools, and so there's a major conversation going on right now about why was there no planning for an underground safe room when you were going to the expense to build a multi-million dollar school with public money. Why did we not do this?
That's Rachel Hubbard with KOSU in Oklahoma City. Rachel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's bring in engineer and meteorologist Tim Marshall of Hague Engineering. He's in Moore inspecting buildings for the National Weather Service, and he's inspected both the devastated elementary schools, Plaza Towers Elementary, where seven children died, and Briarwood, which thankfully had no fatalities. Tim, Plaza Towers had traditional classes running along a hallway. Briarwood had pods of open classrooms. Do we know why Briarwood fared better?
There was a lot of luck involved with the fact that there were no fatalities there. both schools had unreinforced concrete masonry units, just simply block walls that collapsed. And these were in classrooms. So it provided really no safe haven for students except in some isolated areas such as hallways.
You know, this is all hindsight, but everybody is thinking now how to go forward. These schools have to be rebuilt. Is this just wishful thinking that a safe room will protect all children, or can it?
Well, you need a huge room to do that in, and it needs to be reinforced properly. The concept today seems to be moving in that direction, which I like, but not all schools can do that. Obviously, it costs a lot of money for that. My big push is to have certain areas of the school designated as a hardened area and have those areas like hallways, interior hallways especially, to have such hardening that they don't collapse.
And what do you mean by hardening?
That is to reinforce the walls and go ahead and grout the cells that are in the block themselves and put steel rebar and make sure that that steel rebar is tied to the foundation as well as to the roof, so that it provides a uniform load path, or just like links of a chain, it's each link is just as strong as the other link.
And forgive me, grout the cells?
Yeah, grout is a cementitious
mixture.
It's like cement and sand mixture, and you pour that in to the actual cells or hollowed area of each of these blocks.
And do we understand that the Briarwood Elementary School, again, where the children survived, that it did have at least one reinforced hallway?
It may have. It was a central hallway, which is important because the idea is to put as many walls between you and the outside as possible to take that wind load. And the last thing, of course, is the interior. So that is actually the place that I would be myself.
That's Tim Marshall, an engineer and meteorologist with Hague Engineering. He's working with the National Weather Service in Moore. Tim Marshall, thanks so much.
You bet.
Well, the East Coast was also slammed by nature last October, so we want to spend some time in the next couple of weeks asking, how are those states that were then hard hit recovering from Hurricane Sandy? New Jersey FEMA says there were 39 related deaths, $30 billion in damage in that state. Governor Chris Christie promised the famous shore would be open by Memorial Day. He's even appearing in a series of commercials with his family, encouraging people to come.
The Jersey Shore is open.
The word is spreading.
Because we're stronger than the storm.
You bet we are.
Well, some towns, Ocean City, Asbury Park, Atlantic City, are ready. But overall, 365,000 homes were damaged. 189,000 businesses were affected. 19,000 small businesses with $250,000 or more in damage. So today, a look at how they're doing. Brian Donahue is a reporter and video commentator for the Star-Ledger in New Jersey. He joins us from WBGO in Newark. So, Brian, what have you been hearing and seeing? Can this deadline be met?
It's a complicated question. Take Seaside Heights, for example, which has the big commercial boardwalk with a lot of amusements. Two piers anchor that town, and one pier, the Funtown Pier, will not be ready for this year. They're hoping maybe for next summer, and the other pier is half going to be in operation.
Yeah.
You know, when they say New Jersey's open for business, the Jersey Shore is open, but I would say it's probably half open.
Well, take Seaside Heights, as you have been. The mayor there says tourism dollars make up 55% of his budget. 35% is property taxes. He's lost both. Let's start with the numbers here. How much revenue overall is at stake?
It's a huge amount of money. These areas are largely, especially the barrier islands, are largely reliant on tourism. And in those areas, it's just 3 months. That's why it's interesting that we have this sort of deadline for recovery, this Memorial Day.
And I understand that it's $19 billion worth, last year at least. And now you've got studies. There's one out of Rutgers from the School of Planning and Public Policy. They're estimating $950 million loss for the third quarter. That's July through September of this year. So, I mean, there's a lot of money at stake and a lot of potential jobs. I mean, tell us more about what Governor Christie wants to do, how much he wants to spend to fix the area, and the many different reasons that'll be a good thing for him.
Well, it's an election year. And he has getting high poll numbers for his handling of Hurricane Sandy. And there's a huge amount of federal money coming in now that was approved by Congress, and that's being doled out in a very slow process. Now, while Christie was very harshly criticized Congress for being so slow in approving this money, I have to say that a lot of that money still hasn't come through the state channels and been doled out to the people. Some of the programs are not even up and running to distribute that money. And that's where you get a lot of frustration of property owners and homeowners.
This just spirals out into so many other problems. I'm reading that in Seabright, 1,400 people are unable to return because of delayed or unexpectedly low flood insurance settlement payments. I'm guessing that in a lot of cases, this is rental property that will not be available.
I met a family in Seaside Heights, and Seabright is a similar situation, who have two rental properties. One they were going to sell to put their kids through college, and the other they were going to retire to. They had flood insurance. They had an estimate for $200,000 in damage, and they got $79,000. And there's new FEMA flood elevation maps where these homes are going to have to be raised up. They don't know how high they have to raise it. Those maps are not out yet, and they don't know how much it's going to cost. After 6 months of dealing with this, there's a real psychological toll it's taken on people, and you start to wonder, how long do they deal with this? Or do they just wait until a developer comes along and buys them out? And then what does that do?
Well, then there's Harry and Sue McLaughlin. They have a home in Lavalette, New Jersey, that his grandfather built in 1946. It took on 3 feet of water. They lost everything. He's a retired plumber. They had no flood insurance. At first, they weren't sure if they want to stay, but they did decide to go ahead and rebuild. Let's listen.
We're going to take it down and build another house.
Like a modular up? Or
no, I'm going to build it myself.
You're going to build it?
Yep. Well, you know, I feel sorry for some of the people that are the real old people that have been down here. I mean, they're displaced now. I mean, they might never come back. They can't afford it. They can't afford to rebuild. It's tough.
So I started by asking about rentals, because if rentals are gone, you don't have places for tourists to stay. But if residents are gone, you don't have towns. You met another man. Is it Fred Ziegler in Point Pleasant Beach? What has he decided to do?
Fred is in his mid-70s and is living in a FEMA trailer. He finally has one electrical outlet in his house working. It's totally flooded. He had fuel oil that came in with the flood and settled in his floorboards. And this is a guy whose father ran a commercial fishing boat, and he grew up in this house in Point Pleasant Beach. He still plans on getting back into the house and fixing it up and selling it. And these are the kind of people that are really the heart and soul of the old shore. You know, Harry McLaughlin, who you just mentioned, spends his winters making duck decoys and catches tuna from his boat, and was a plumber. And this is what the Jersey Shore has always been, these kind of people. And they're really the ones who are getting hit the hardest, because they may have inherited the house, or the house may have been paid off a long time ago, and that makes them less likely to have flood insurance. If you need flood insurance to get a mortgage, but if your mortgage is paid off and you're looking for ways to cut costs, a lot of people just didn't have flood insurance. They never saw this extensive damage before. You're really going to see, I think, a population shift, especially among older people at the shore. And a lot of people retired to the shore or did retire to the shore. And I think a lot of them are just not going to come back.
That's Brian Donahue of New Jersey Star-Ledger giving us a taste of what it's like when a horrific storm passes through. By the way, the iconic Jetstar roller coaster that you saw floating in the water in Seaside Heights was taken down earlier this month. We have an incredible time-lapse video of that at hereandnow.org. We're with Brian in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. Do you have a spot that you go to in the summer? Maybe it's just a park or a lake, just a trail? What if it weren't there? We're checking in on the Jersey Shore, so badly damaged by Hurricane Sandy. Towns trying to open by Memorial Day. Many are, and they're doing it for the people who've lived there for generations, for some a low-cost way to have a vacation, but also for the revenue from tourists coming from across the country. But will they come? Brian Donahue is a reporter and video commentator for the Star-Ledger in New Jersey. He's also trying to find out if residents are going to stay. Missing this Memorial Day, the Twisted Fish. That's a store that sold T-shirts and sandals and other beach necessities on the boardwalk in Seaside Heights. Brian spoke with owner Doug Woodfield and asked him if he was going to stick it out.
I've been on the boardwalk for 43 years. My lease is up here now, and I'm going to pack it in.
Between Hurricane Irene and between this, it's... rent's a little too high. I don't have confidence that we're going to make our rent this year, and I'm going to pack it up.
How do you feel?
I feel like saying goodbye to 43 years of my life.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's tough.
You think Seaside will be different?
Oh, yeah.
Very different. Very different.
Yeah. But they will put the boardwalk back together, and it will still get that honky-tonk flavor back, and it will still become fun again.
But, Brian, do you think they're going to be able to put that honky-tonk flavor that draws so many people and keeps so many residents after this rebuilding?
The thing about the Jersey Shore and the great thing about it has been that there are 126 miles, town after town, and everyone is so different. There's always been a place for everyone to kind of find their place. The danger that I see and the thing that concerns me is that things become more homogenized. And that's something we have already seen over the past couple of decades here at the Shore. In the case of Seaside Heights, which is the, I would say, the epicenter of honky-tonk for the Jersey Shore, there's a lot of going to be an economic pressure on these people to go upscale.
When you say to go upscale, is that what you alluded to before? You know, if you have to rebuild, why not rebuild something hugely expensive and sell it? Or
we've seen in other parts of the Shore, especially a town called Long Branch, which had classic boardwalk culture, amusements and rides, and in the 80s it burned down, and there were cries, oh, we're going to rebuild it, it'll be just like it was. Well, it's not. It was rebuilt, and it became condos and sort of a glorified upscale mall. It's not what little kids dream of going to in the summertime. One planner put it to me, you just can't support a penny arcade at today's real estate prices. That's the conundrum there. But on the other hand, you're looking at like the Funtown Pier in Seaside Heights. There was a plan there about 10 or 20 years ago to put condos there. It never worked. And now I wonder, actually, with Sandy, whether anyone would want to live in a condo in front of the ocean after what we've seen, the destruction. So maybe Sandy could save the honky-tonk in the end. We don't know.
Well, but the only thing that will save the area, if it's not condos and high-end homes, it's still got to be rental properties, because that's really what helps drive the economy. You say the rental market is about 50 to 60% available, but it's not filled by now, which it usually is. Now, I know the New Jersey Board of Tourism wants me to say, everybody come, because it's still going to be great and it's still going to be beaches. And I want to hear about that. But what is the concern about whether or not the rental property is going to be able to come back? You mentioned people are waiting on FEMA requirements, whether or not to raise or lower homes, but what about things like debris? Is it even safe?
Anytime we talk about the Shore in general, especially post-Sandy, I think we need to be clear that a lot of the Shore is in really good shape, especially the southern portion of the Shore, down by Wildwoods and generally the places where the Philly crowd will go. The bulk of the damage was in the north, and this is the places where we have this incredible uncertainty. A realtor I spoke with said 50% to 60% of the homes, the rentals, are available, but only 30% have been signed leases for this. So there's this perception that even in areas where things are okay, people are seeing these images in the media and thinking that it's completely destroyed.
Or that when they get there for their 2 weeks of vacation, there's going to be construction going on all around them. Or there might be, look out, it's a railing from a roller coaster coming in on the next wave.
There's a couple issues with people are finding when they're looking to rent. And the realtors are saying the biggest question that people are having is, can we swim? There's other issues. You don't want to have to hear saws and construction sounds going on in the morning. There's also a little bit of survivor's guilt. And I've thought about this myself when I'm down there doing my 2 weeks in August. To walk to the beach, you know, I'm going to put my daughters in a wagon and walk up to the beach like we do. I'm going to have to walk by some houses where people have not been made whole yet. It's going to be a little difficult psychologically to have to sort of step over people's misery in order to get to the beach. And I don't know how widespread that's going to be.
Yeah. Well, but you also did take your daughter to the beach recently and discovered something else, that people may be worrying too much in the long run.
I think so. I had a job. I had to shoot a video on a beach that was really heavily damaged. Houses toppled over on their sides, just lying in splinters. Really dramatic stuff. And she's 7 years old, and she loves the Shore. This kid wakes up on, you know, February mornings asking, you know, how many days till we can go to the boardwalk. And I was worried about what this was going to do to her, whether she was going to be afraid. She also has nightmares about tornadoes. So I was, you know, we talked on the way to the beach, and I told her that you're going to see some things that you're never going to forget. And we got to the beach, and she got out of the car and ran past all of that and didn't pay one lick of attention to it. She went right down to the sand and started making a sandcastle. And I realized that the kids don't see what's destroyed. They just see what's there. And I realized then that the summer's going to be fine for us. We're going to go down there, and we're going to have a great summer at the beach. There's a chance that we might have the beach to ourselves. which is a little sad, but it also, it could be wonderful. So it is going to be a very strange summer down there, but it could be, you know, strange in some good ways.
Well, and of course, New Jersey tourism authorities hope that people find their way to the places that are whole. Just remind us, what are the places that are completely whole?
The southern area parts of the shore are really going to be fine. The Wildwood area, the Cape May area, Ocean City. It's when you get onto the Northern Barrier Island. And even on that Northern Barrier Island, Lavalette has really in the past months really come back. So there's one town, and then the next town over in Ortley Beach, which is just complete destruction. So it's pockets of destruction. It's where the ocean just decided to come in. It has to do with, you know, a foot or two of elevation. So even in these areas where there is a lot of destruction, I think people just need to go down, check it out, and you're going to find a place.
And help a region when you do. Brian Donahue, reporter and video commentator for the Star-Ledger in New Jersey. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you can watch Splinters and Sand, that's the mini documentary Brian produced about the Jersey Shore, at hereandnow.org, where there's also a link to a live webcam showing current conditions on the seaside boardwalk if you're heading that way this summer. Latest news is next, Here and Now. There are many unanswered questions at this hour about an incredible story. A young Chechen boxer from Florida was shot and killed at his home in Orlando last night by law enforcement officials who were interviewing him about his friendship with Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the Chechen Boston Marathon bombing suspect who was killed. NBC is reporting that during his interview with the FBI, 27-year-old Ibrahim Todashev lunged at agents with a knife after confessing to being part of a triple murder in the Boston area in which a friend of the bombing suspect, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, was killed. That triple murder happened on the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks 2 years ago. The Associated Press is also reporting that Todashev, the man who was killed in Florida, once lived in Watertown, the same Boston suburb where Tsarnaev, the bombing suspect, was killed in that police shootout last month. Now, a Chechen friend of Todashev's, the Florida man, told WSEH-TV in Orlando this morning that Todashev had no connection to terrorism.
He felt like there's going to be set up, bad set up against him, you know what I mean? He told me, like, they are making up such a crazy stuff. I don't know why they're doing it. Why they doing it? Okay, I'm answering the questions, but they're still making up some, like, connections, some crazy stuff.
Okay, joining us on the line from Orlando, WESH reporter Stuart Moore. He's the one who got that interview. Stuart, this is very complicated, especially for people outside the Boston area who haven't been following all of this and weren't aware of this triple murder that happened 2 years ago. But start with what happened there in Florida. Your FBI sources said that Todashev, the alleged friend of the Boston bombing suspect, that he flipped out during an interview?
Yes, they have. What I learned from the FBI here is that ever since the Boston bombing, they have been in contact with the suspect here, as well as the friend that we interviewed, asking them questions about their relationship to the Boston Marathon bombing suspect, as well as any extremists overseas. Now, they are all from Chechnya, and they said that they were actually conducting one of those interviews, as they have done many times before, and the suspect in this case actually got very aggressive towards them, and that's when they said that they had no choice but to open fire, shooting and killing him. Now, the person that we interviewed, who also was questioned, said that he was being interviewed by the FBI just about an hour or two before this shooting actually happened. He said that he has been followed and interviewed by the FBI several different times, said they had nothing to do whatsoever with terrorism. And actually, when the Boston Marathon attacks happened, both of them were pretty shaken up. But now, one thing he did confirm is that the suspect that was killed this morning had spoken to the Boston Marathon bombing suspect just a week before that attack actually played out. So yeah. a lot more questions that still need to be answered. I just called that person just a while ago to find out what he knew about his involvement with the triple murder that happened in Boston. He has not yet called me back on that tip.
Well, let me hold you up there. Let me hold you up there, Stuart, because this triple murder that, again, this Florida man, Todashev, reportedly confessed involvement in, this is a local hip-hop artist, two other young men killed on the 9/11 anniversary 2 years ago, a brutal murder, their throats slit. The families of those men had wanted this case reopened because they felt that one of these men at least had a friendship with the Boston bombing suspect. They wanted the triple murder looked at again in light of the Boston bombing. What more do we know about what Todashev said his role was, or any role that Tamerlan Tsarnaev might have had?
Well, NBC News is confirming that Todashev actually confessed right before that outburst happened, where he was shot and killed. And they also we are learning that the suspect in this case, you know, he confessed to the actual murders that were involved in Boston. And now I guess he's been here for the past 2 years since that crime actually happened. One thing that we did find out from the suspect's friend who we spoke to this morning is that he was actually planning on going back to Chechnya this past Sunday. But the FBI encouraged him not to go back and told him that they still have more questions for him because he said he's just received his green card. So it's a lot of things that are still developing with this case. We do know that a team is coming down from Washington, D.C. To take this over.
Stuart Moore, again, with WESH-TV in Orlando, Florida. Quite something. We'll keep an eye on this story. And thank you for doing so for us. Stuart, thank you.
No problem. Have a great day.
Okay. I'm going to take a break. Be right back here and now. A quick note on news we're keeping an eye on. A House panel is expected to vote later today to change military law so that commanding officers won't be able to modify or throw out court-martials or sexual assault offenders. Also, the head of the IRA office that oversees tax-exempt status applications says she did not break the law, but that's all Lois Lerner would say at a House hearing on IRS targeting of conservative groups. She pled the fifth as expected. We'll keep an eye on these news stories. But we are also jump-starting summer today with a look at the musician who wrote the soundtrack for so many summers, Prince. Our guest is Touré, co-host of MSNBC's The Cycle and a columnist for Time.com. In his new book, I Would Die For You, Why Prince Became an Icon, Touré makes the case that Prince was an icon for Gen X and takes the reader through the various stages of the cultural cross he says Prince helped his generation carry. They were more than any previous generation children of divorce. They were sexually active in the age of AIDS, the first in which mixed race was common. The first video generation, and by the way, a warning, a lot of that video was pornography. And Touré says Prince was their guide through all of this. He joins us from NPR in New York. Touré, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me once again.
Well, describe again this generation that you're talking about, born between 65 and 82.
Yeah, I mean, we were a generation that was shaped by divorce, by latchkey kids, which is not necessarily the same thing. A lot of women went into the workforce for the first time. Some latchkey kids are from divorce. Some latchkey kids are from two-career families. But divorce had a massive impact on our generation. Also, the rise of what I call porn chic, because, of course, in the late 70s and early 80s, the VCR, which had actually been created in the 50s, became suddenly this very popular device that almost everybody had. That was driven by the making of low-cost pornography tapes. So instead of people going outside of their homes to watch pornography, which necessarily stigmatized it, people were able to watch pornography at home. And so it started to become part of popular culture in this way. I mean, even in a film like Empire Strikes Back, right, you see Princess Leia at the feet of Jabba the Hutt, right? Remember in the gold bikini with the chain?
Where are you going
and a
here?
A lot of young boys were blown away by that image. So in this way, you see pornography, right, sort of entering the mainstream. And Prince was perfectly positioned to take advantage of that.
She took me to her castle and I just couldn't believe my eyes. She had so many devices, everything that money could buy. She said, sign your name on a dotted line. The lights went out and Nikki started to grind.
The song Darling Nikki, laced with sexuality, as was Prince. But just hold up a second there, Touré, because you've said a lot here. You admit that a lot of what you know about Prince and a lot of what we know about Prince is mythologized. So when you see a lot of Gen Xers relating to his family situation, we know that his parents separated when he was seven. He was said to have gone to live with his father. His father maybe kicked him out. We don't know what's true, but with what you can figure out what is true of his family, how do Gen Xers relate to that?
When he talks about strange relationships, or in a song like When Doves Cry, the way that he's talking about mom, dad, you know, there's clearly tension there. he's speaking in a way that if you have come from a broken home or a home that came close to divorce, that relates to you, that speaks to you. You know, a previous generation might have spoken more about, you know, I always love my mama and, you know, daddy's so great and, you know, and that's fabulous, but that may not have fit or might have seemed quaint if you're coming from a generation where, well, my parents broke up and, you know, my friend's parents broke up and that had a big impact on our lives, or my uncle and aunt broke up and then my, you know, my cousin came to live with us and I just saw that tension. Prince is speaking to us about our experiences, and whether or not we know that he had those similar experiences is immaterial.
So you're showing us how your generation related to Prince on these different levels. Another thing that was perhaps unique about the Generation X teens, they had their own telephones. What did that have to do with their relationship with Prince?
I remember it became quite normal that there would either be a second phone or, you know, some people had in their homes like that really long cord. So you're able to have conversations away from your parents. And what are teenagers talking about all the time? If not sex itself, then potential partners, or talking to the partners they want, or talking to their friends about the partners they want. So the phone privacy that emerges from the beginning of the 70s to the end of the 70s allows more of us to sit around and talk about who we want to be with and how we might make that happen.
I keep your picture beside my bed.
Well, one of the things they also might have been talking about is, what do you think of Prince? What do you think Prince is? Does he like men or does he like women? I mean, he played sexual androgyny. Yeah.
Yes, a lot of them might have been talking about Prince and or Michael Jackson and or Madonna, because there were fewer radio stations than we have now. There was no internet, obviously. There was MTV, which functioned as the biggest radio station in America. An album would come out, a lot of people would buy it, and you would have a community of people to talk about stuff with. We don't really have that now. There is no equivalent to MTV. Social media does not function in a way to create instant community around music. It's not that an album comes out and everybody is aware of it in the same way that MTV would make everybody aware of it at the same time. And it wasn't even like, are you listening to Prince? It was, what do you think of that new Prince album? What do you think of the new Prince single, Prince video? And this existed for, not just for Prince, obviously, for Michael, for Madonna, you know, for Bruce, and, you know, for some others, you know, U2 perhaps. So there were people who were able to create big, huge tents, and it is much, much, much harder now.
As Turay, his new book is I Would Die For You, Why Prince Became an Icon. We're jump-starting summer with a longer music break. We'll have more in a minute, here and now. It's Here and Now. We are taking a pre-summer musical break, talking to cultural commentator Turay about his new book, I Would Die For You, Why Prince Became an Icon.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else. The afterworld. A world of never-ending happiness.
Touré says Prince played sort of wise older brother to Gen X kids marked by their parents' divorce. Latchkey kids born between 1965 and 82.
So when you call up that shrink in Beverly Hills, you know the one. Doctor, everything will be all right. Instead of asking mama,
Prince defied traditional categories of gender and sexuality as Gen X kids were viewing both in a new way. And Touré, you say he also did that with race?
Gen X was a period when you had more sort of biracial knowledge than we'd had before, more whites interested in and aware of black culture and vice versa. So you had, you know, Spike Lee movies, Eddie Murphy becomes a gigantic star. There was crossover. For the first time, it was not embarrassing or sellout-ish to be crossing over from, you know, black communities or black cultural communities into white, and was not strange for whites to know a lot about black culture. So, you know, years later, the sort of children of this become like, you know, the people who make like the Chappelle Show, which is built on a black guy who knows a lot about white culture and a white guy who knows a lot about black culture, as well as their own cultures. What Prince and Michael Jackson did was they said, I don't want to be just famous within the black community. I want the world. I want everything. And Prince really attacked it in an interesting way because there was actual segregation within the music business at that point. If you were a black artist, you would go into the urban department, right, which would typically be have a smaller budget, have a smaller staff, and we would try to promote you to Soul Train, Black Radio, these sorts of things. You know, if you were a white star, they would put you with the pop staff, which would be bigger, have a bigger budget, and would try to get you the whole world. Prince came in and he said to the labels, do not try to just put me with the urban group. I want the world. I want to be with the pop staff. I'm going to make rock and roll as well as soul, as well as funk, as well as all these sort of things. So I don't want to just go to Soul Train. I don't want to just open up for Rick James. I want to be on Dick Clark. I want everything. And part of that push was that he told us that he was mixed. He is not mixed. His parents are both black. And it's not about a rejection of blackness. This music is extraordinarily black. His affect is extraordinarily black. But just to say, you know, just to create a bit of mystery, that was not quite a normal-ish thing in the 80s. And also to say, don't just sort of lump me with all the other black artists. I want the world.
Well, speaking of which, the song Purple Rain, which is so spiritual for so many, came from that same place, you say. It was because Prince's 1990 tour followed Bob Seger's tour through America, and he saw Seger have these huge crowds and stadium crowds, and he wanted that. And he wrote the song to get that response.
He wanted that sort of anthemic arena power ballad. It's a song about redemption. And Prince is absolving the speaker, saying, you know, that you are not a bad person. This relationship is ending. You had the best of intentions, and, you know, you did the best you could. And then in the last verse, he almost comes out and says it. There's this religious thing to him, but it's more than just being a person in the pews. He's either thinking that he is behind the pulpit or, you know, in the stained glass itself is thinking like he is, you know, the second coming of Jesus or something. So in the third verse of Purple Rain, he talks about you want a leader. You know, you can't make up your mind. You need to close it and let me guide you to the purple rain, rain, of course, being a baptismal symbol. Water is quite often a baptismal symbol. So if he's leading you, close your mind and follow me into the purple rain. Either he is John the Baptist or he is Jesus. All I want to be some kind of friend.
This resonates, again, as you say, with your generation, the most secular, the generation yeah. with less religious engagement than any before. You cite Pew Forum polls to say that. Is this where it gets a little bit dangerous? It's one thing to think, as Prince does, you quote all sorts of scenes where he's talking about how the music is coming through him and he just can't stop writing it and he feels he's this vessel, and becoming somewhat messianic. I mean, tell us more about that, how this intersects with Gen X.
Well, I think that Prince wants to present himself in this sort of Jesus mode. I don't think that Generation X was looking at him as a Jesus figure to follow, but it was a period of declining religious engagement for Gen X. But, you know, I think the spiritual impulse is natural, right? That we all feel it, even if we don't go to church, we need something. And, you know, there were a lot of people who were following, worshiping celebrity at another level. And when you have Prince as this massive celebrity, you know, who's sort of feeding your sexual needs and also giving you this sort of spiritual, religious thing, it's a very seductive cocktail.
If he is sort of the soundtrack of your generation, Gen X, we know he's putting out new songs on his website, he's on tour. What is he representing for you now?
He can't mean the same to us as he did when we were growing up with him. It's impossible because, you know, there were communities, there was, you know, identities being formed around him and what he was saying. At this age, it's good music. It reminds you of what you loved, but it can't be the same.
That's Touré. His new book, I Would Die For You, Why Prince Became an icon for his generation, Gen X. And Touré, I have to say, it was the details. It was so much fun to read, for instance, that he's a great basketball player, but has at times played in high heels.
Yeah.
We'll have an excerpt at herenow.org. Touré, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And by the way, we want to introduce a new voice to Here and Now. She's going to be sitting in for me frequently because I'm going to get a knee taken care of. Meghna Chakrabarty.
I wore my beret since you're talking about Prince.
Appropriate. Meghna, I'm going to take a second to tell you the secret of doing this show. Oops, out of time.
The secret is do what Robin does.
Meghna, welcome.
Thanks so much, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now. Whoa.